Human Services. I don't know where all the Republicans are, but hopefully they show up at some point. Although I'm very comfortable with the Democrats on my committee, so that's no problem with me.
It's a good thing.
It is. And I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of LC drafts as committee bills. And I will basically go from Representative Jensen's script as of yesterday. This is only for the purposes of having them drafted as committee bills. This does not mean you support or do not support the bill. We will have full discussion of the issues once they come back in bill form. So I would entertain a motion on LC 2365.
I move we send LC 2365 to what? To
no.
Introduce.
Mr. Chair, I move LC draft 2365 to be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Tomei moves LC draft 2365 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill
LC
2963 to be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Tomei moves LC 2963 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session. And we'll open an informational meeting. And first up is Liz Merton. Lise. It's been a long week, kids. And Tom.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, for the record, my name is Lise Merton. I'm with the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. I'm the Northwest Regional Director, and I'm based in Olympia, Washington. I wanted to thank you for inviting us here today to talk about what I understand is some options and some ideas to look at saving monies with the Oregon Health Plan as well as the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I'm hoping that our presentation this morning will give you some ideas of where we might be able to save some money. I have given you or getting, I believe, prepared text, and in the interest of time and brevity, since there's so many other people behind us, I won't read from the script, but I wanted to highlight some of the points in the handout that I've given you. The National Association of Chain Drug Stores in Oregon represents Albertsons, Costco, CVS, Hagen's, or some of you know it, Top Foods, High School, Kmart, Long's, Medicine Shop, Medicap, NCS Healthcare, Rite Aid, Safeway, Shopko, Target, Walmart, and Walgreens. Between the chains and the independent pharmacies, there are 569 pharmacies in the state of Oregon, employing just under 38,000 people, and contributing approximately $22.5 million in taxes every year. As most of you know, pharmacists provide a multitude of services at the point of sale to customers, both on state-assisted programs as well as those of us in the private sector. They provide counseling, they provide drug interaction reviews, and many times they're the first line of defense for customers as they become ill. They go to their pharmacist rather than perhaps making a doctor's appointment. So they're an important part in the whole healthcare arena. Community pharmacies operate on a very competitive marketplace. There are over 50,000 community pharmacies in this country. 95% of all Americans live within 5 miles of a pharmacy. So as you can see, it's an extremely competitive market for our folks. Getting into the increased cost of prescription drugs, I would like to point out that 39% of the prescription drug spending in 2001 was due to the use of prescription drugs, as compared to 61%, which was due to the increase in the prices of prescription drugs. Pardon me. To set a framework for our discussion today, one of the things I wanted to point out is that community pharmacies, when they buy prescription drugs, buy drugs more on the order of what of how you and I would buy stocks. If we buy 10 shares of a stock at $50, we don't get a break if we buy 100 shares of that same stock. And that is very much and very similar to the way that prescription drugs are purchased by the retail pharmacies, as opposed to what we think, thank you very much, Sandy, as opposed to what we think in terms of buying large volumes and being discounts with the volumes. That's not how it works in the retail pharmacy community. In my comments today, what I'd like to do is encourage this body to look at the entire healthcare system. I realize we're here today to talk about prescription drugs, but I don't think you can do that effectively without looking at how brand and generic drugs play an important role when used properly in the overall healthcare system. So although we are just focusing on drugs, we also need to look, as we look at the Oregon Health Plan and hopefully fixing it, and at OMAP and being able to serve the populations that need our help, what I would ask this group to look at is the overall healthcare systems, and that includes hospitals, physicians, all the different components. Because if you just look at one, there's sometimes the misnomer that by fixing one, you're not impacting the others, and that's not necessarily the case. So I'd ask you, as you go through your process, and I know you're working very hard on this, to look at the entire healthcare system, not just one component of it. We understand and are sympathetic to the budget for shortfalls being experienced by Oregon this year. And as I listened to the news this morning, I understand it's just getting worse between now and the end of June. So for that, I'm very sorry, and hopefully we can help you with that. We have, I have actually made a call to Ms. Reed at OMAP, and one of the things that we offer as a service at the National Association of Chain Drug Stores is the opportunity for states to enter into agreement with the University of Texas to run a study for the state that we actually pay for, so there's no expense to the state, to identify what the state is doing well in areas of opportunities where they can be doing better, and perhaps even cost-saving measures that they hadn't looked at yet in terms of being able to be better stewards of the taxpayers' money. And that is something that, again, I have a call in to Ms. Reed. I have been out of town, so in fairness to her, we have not had a chance to connect, but it is something that I will continue to pursue, especially now with the delay in implementation of the reduction in reimbursement rate. But something I would ask this group as we go through the presentation today to your help in encouraging them to think about entering into an agreement like that would be greatly appreciated. Things that I'd like to focus on.
We, maybe Tom and I can talk about that. That we can maybe put that into a bill if we feel that's necessary to require that. What would be a turnaround on that? Would we hope
from the time the University of Texas receives the data, we can turn around in some cases a week, at the outset 2 weeks. So we could have, but it's once. But basically, the responsibility of OMAP would be to put together the data, and we have the data set, so it's something that I can email down to Ms. Reed at any time. There are certain data sets that they need in order to do this, and it's patient specific data. But once the University of Texas receives that data, the turnaround time at the outset is 2 weeks.
So theoretically, a month or two, we could have results. Let's talk about that. Let's see if we can make that happen.
Yeah, and in other states, I'll be very frank with you, we've not had to use legislation. So, we're doing it right now in Utah.
I think OMAP's going
to
be...
I don't think there's resistance to it. She and I just have not had the opportunity to discuss it. So I just wanted to let you know that that is an offer that we have on the table and would like to pursue with the department.
Okay, good to know that.
There are many, many, many cost-saving opportunities out there for Medicaid departments, and I'm going to kind of focus my attention on Medicaid because of the potential reimbursement rate reduction. That's kind of my mind frame these days, but clearly these would apply to the Oregon Health Plan overall as well. One of the areas that we are looking at and that we have found to be very successful throughout the country are preferred drug lists. And Oregon has done an excellent job in a first step. In 2001, you passed a voluntary preferred drug list piece of legislation. What I'd like to do is talk to you about some of the opportunities that have existed in other states and how they have been able to successfully save a great deal of money by combining a preferred drug list with supplemental rebates with prior authorization programs. And rather than go through all the details of all the states, what I would like to do is focus on three states that are doing very well. Florida has put into place a preferred drug list, and they have a lot of other components, but all I want to talk about today is a preferred drug list and their supplemental rebate program and their prior authorization program. After its first year of operation in Florida, the program had generated over $68 million in savings, which is 4% of their overall drug budget, from increased supplemental rebates, and $36 million, which represents 2.18% of the savings from prior authorization and their preferred drug list. Using Oregon's number, and this is not an exact science, but using Oregon's numbers as compared to Florida's, in that same time period, Oregon potentially could have saved $9.1 million on supplemental rebates and $6.4 million on effective prior authorization programs utilizing a preferred drug list. In December of 2001, there were over 1,300 drugs on the Florida preferred drug list. In Michigan, which is another program that we have found to be very effective, after only 2 months of operation, the Michigan program was showing savings of over $500,000 per week from more appropriate utilization of drugs. Again, comparing Michigan numbers to Oregon numbers, again, not exact science, and these are the kinds of things that this study can generate for you, the savings would have been here $195,000 per week using an effective preferred drug list. In Vermont, they were able to reduce spending by 26.3% in just three categories of Medicaid-covered drugs over a seven-month period from March to September of 2002.
Yeah,
oh, I'm sorry.
Ramona Sanderson.
When you say savings, are you saying savings to the pharmacy, savings to the general fund, savings to who are you talking
to? I'm talking about savings. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Moniz Anderson, I'm talking about savings to the department. In other words, that they would not be spending that money because they're doing a better job of utilizing the funds that they have. So it would help fill the hole. So no, it's not savings to us. In Vermont, they were able to reduce spending to 26.3% in just three categories of Medicaid drugs in a seven-month period. Again, using a comparing Oregon numbers, that would have translated here to $60.1 million. So there's the point being that when you look at a preferred drug list, if it is mandated and it is effectively done, looking at the appropriate use of drugs, not looking at just the cost of drugs, but looking at their efficacy first, cost second, there are a lot of savings that can be achieved to the department and to the general fund in spending without jeopardizing access to the Medicaid recipients that are out there. In your handout, and I'm not going to go into this, but there's also the legal status of the preferred drug list. Pardon me. That may be of interest to you, as you know, we often have legal challenges to a number of these programs, and I just wanted to be clear that these have all withstood legal challenges. Some of the other cost savings ideas that I wanted to share with you, and I'm not going to go into details, they're all detailed in your handout, but I just wanted to bring these up. Expanding prior authorization. And as I talk about these programs in terms of saving money to the state, I would want to point out to you, and I hope you would understand, that it takes the participation of community pharmacies. It takes a lot of work on the part of community pharmacies to make these programs work. So it's our way of saying we want to help you save money in exchange, we hope, for not reducing our reimbursement rate. But it isn't you need to go do this. It's something that has to be done together cooperatively in order for these different programs to work. Expanding prior authorization, expanding drug utilization review, enhancing retrospective drug utilization reviews. When we did our study in Washington last year, one of the charts we asked the University of Texas to put together for us was a drug utilization chart, and we basically said from using 9 drugs per month, and this went up to greater than 30. And what it basically shows, this is patient-specific information we're asking for, but it's done in such a way that we couldn't say, you wouldn't know that it was my Lise Merton's information. It's done in such a way that you have a number that isn't related to necessarily an individual, so you wouldn't be able to tell who it is. What we were able to determine that there were over 2,000 people in the state of Washington on the Medicaid program who were taking over 30 drugs a month. And that's the kind of information we can generate with a study from Texas, which tells us, as a healthcare community, those are folks we need to go look at and see what's going on, because obviously that's not an appropriate utilization of drugs. I mean, we were joking this morning, I take like 5 vitamins a day, and it's all I can do to get those down. So when people are talking about 30, it's staggering to me. But you see what happens. Somebody takes a particular drug, they have an adverse reaction, they get another drug to deal with the adverse reaction, but the existing problem that precipitated the first prescription has not in fact gone away. So another prescription is generated, but nobody told them to quit taking that first one. So right there, we're already up to 3. And those are the kinds of things that happen, that by looking at and doing case management of those individuals, pardon me, we're able to actually help them do a better job of utilizing their drugs and, in fact, saving the state money, because it's not an appropriate use of those drugs and an expenditure of funds. In some states, we've implemented a 4-brand limit that seems to be working fairly well. I know with our colleagues from the manufacturers in some states, a 7-drug limit is working very well. So there are things out there that we're willing to work on with the department and with our colleagues in the other healthcare arenas to try and facilitate in terms of cost savings. Disease state management are programs I believe we're going to be hearing a little bit about later this morning. We definitely support the disease state management programs. And I will let you know that in Mississippi, Medicaid actually reimburses pharmacists for participating in the disease state management programs that, in fact, save the state money. So, again, it's this partnership between the Medicaid department and the pharmacies and the physicians working with the individual patients to make things better for them and also save money at the same time. Increased generic substitution is something that we look at. You'll be hearing a little bit more about that this morning in terms of the potential savings that could be involved there for the state. The payment of incentives to switch to generic equivalents. I know Tom and some of the other folks are doing a lot of work with OMAP and looking at that as a possibility to incent the pharmacists to help switch to generics, which again will save the state money. Covering over-the-counter products sometimes is a better utilization than actually a prescription drug. There are situations that arise where OTCs are a much better and equally as effective response to a particular ailment, which may be temporary, than actually having to do a prescription. But because of the way Medicaid works, the reimbursement and the coverage is only going to be if there's actually a prescription, not necessarily with the over-the-counter products. So that's another thing to look at that can be a savings generator. There are 3 pages in your handout that basically show all the different cost-saving mechanisms that are out there. And I did that just to give you an idea of the kinds of things that we support and are willing to work with the department on to try and identify better savings. I will say I was hopeful when I heard Ms. Reed's testimony on Monday, because a lot of the things that she talked to this committee about are things that we share in terms of areas where we would like to help the department save additional funds. Almost done. The last thing I'd like to talk to you about is reducing the reimbursement rate. And what we would strongly encourage this committee and the state to be willing to do is to look at all the different cost-saving mechanisms before looking to reduce the reimbursement rates to any providers that are providing services for Medicaid and throwing anybody off the rolls in an effort to reduce overall state spending. As you know, there are 3 main reasons state Medicaid budgets are increasing: increased utilization, increased prices of drugs, and extremely high cost of new drugs being introduced into the market. Decreasing the reimbursement rate to pharmacists, whether through drug product or dispensing fees, does nothing to get at the root of this problem. Over the past several years, and the state certainly can attest to this after this, what did I hear you say, Mr. Chair? We're in the 6th special session officially as we sit here today. States have been grappling with the high cost of prescription drugs. And what they have done in an attempt to reduce those costs is reduce the reimbursement rate to, in our particular case, obviously, to pharmacies. We are very clear in trying to work with them to identify other opportunities. And every one of those states, including Oregon, is back again looking at further reducing the reimbursement rate to pharmacies. So clearly, reducing the reimbursement rate is not getting at the root of the problem. We would encourage you to help us find a different way to get there, and we're willing to work with you on that. It is a little frightening that in Oregon, we have in less than 2 years, we have gone from 11% to a proposed 17% off of average wholesale price in terms of our reimbursement rate, which can be potentially devastating to our industry. How much is enough? I don't know. And at what point are we willing to acknowledge that there's a cost associated with access when you start reducing reimbursement rates and leaving Medicaid recipients without the access that they need, and which is a basic tenet of Medicaid? Without the structure of community pharmacy, the Medicaid program doesn't work. People on Medicaid are the least able to help themselves, and I see it, I guess, as part of our job to help them help themselves. A mail order is not necessarily something that will work for them, although it certainly will work for some of them. But it, as a whole, it's not necessarily the solution or the answer to fixing this problem. At AWP minus 17 plus 350, many of the drugs our pharmacies dispense would be paid at below cost. Many pharmacists may be forced to close, discontinue service to Medicaid clients, or reduce the clients that they're willing to see from the Medicaid programs, or in some cases even close their doors. I would also like to note that this would give Oregon the distinction of also being the lowest reimbursement state as far as Medicaid goes across the board in the country. A reduction of this magnitude in the program's reimbursement rate will all but eliminate the senior assistance program, which again you discussed on Monday, that has allowed community pharmacists to be able to see to serve some of our senior population through a program, again, a voluntary program that was implemented in 2001 by providing prescription drugs at Medicaid rates to Medicare-eligible citizens of the state. I would again ask this body to work with us and to help us work with the department to identify other cost-saving measures prior to looking at any movement to reducing our reimbursement rate below the current AWP minus 14. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with just about every one of your cost-saving measures, but one idea that you didn't mention, and I'd like to know what the pharmacy has thought about this idea. I know that a lot of physicians, especially clinics, are starting to dispense some drugs in their clinics. And I was wondering, has the pharmacy industry ever thought about partnerships where you could have your techs even just located in these clinics, and there would be just a sub-outlet of pharmacies in the clinics?
Mm-hmm.
And it would be based, you just had the basic drugs there, probably the generic, but has any kind of talk or relationships like that been developed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moniz Anderson, I'd like to defer that conversation, to answer that question to Tom Holt. And the answer to the question is yes, those discussions have taken place, but if it's all right with you, I'd like Tom to expand on that a little
sure.
bit. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom Holt, Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association, Chair Cruz and Representative Moniz Anderson, there are a couple of places in the Midwest where remote dispensing has been arranged where using basically web technology, the home-based pharmacy can visually check the dispensing at a remote location at a physician's office, or more often there's a physician assistant in a clinic in these really remote areas where there's just not good access to providers. That's a fairly new thing that's developed over the last year or so, and it's something that I think the Board of Pharmacy here is looking at their rules to see if that's possible to do. It is important, though, when we look at clinic dispensing and other practitioner dispensing, to make sure that the pharmacy is kept in the loop, because the pharmacy and the pharmacist are a tremendously important backstop for patient safety. There are a number of studies that suggest that, rough average 2 to 3% of the prescriptions that reach a pharmacy have some kind of an error in them that need to be corrected. So without that backstop, you risk having higher error rates, and of course many of those can be pretty serious. So, as long as the pharmacy is in the loop, either through technology or on site, that's something certainly worth exploring to help get the medication to people in remote areas.
Paula? Yeah. Well, you both have, at least in the past, Tom, and in your statements, you're saying case management is so important. And, when you're bringing it where it's an incentive to the physician to be a part of that case management, because I know when I've gone to the pharmacy, they actually help me a little bit more with the case management of generic versus brand, et cetera, all of that piece. So I was just trying to think, is there a way that we could develop that relationship where you still aren't going to be losing business and be a very much a viable part of the physician prescription?
Yeah, if I may, Chair Cruz, Representative Miles Anderson, one of the bills I hope you'll be seeing later in this session is one that we brought modeled on an Iowa case management program that is a partnership completely between pharmacists and physicians, who a panel determines what they should case manage based on high use of prescription drugs and coincident of a high cost chronic condition. It's been very successful. They just came out with a 3-year evaluation, and they are getting better health outcomes, which means better budget results, and it was budget neutral to the drug budget. And I hope we're going to have an opportunity to talk about that in more depth later in the session.
Any other questions? Tom, 2 years ago during our task force, we talked about the four-brand cap in Florida, and it was awfully new at that point in time. Is there any data available on that yet?
Chair Cruz, I believe there is a pretty good data set available on that. The way that program has worked, their prior authorization really kicks in when a patient gets to the fifth branded medication. To clarify, there's the limitation without prior authorization is 4 branded drugs and unlimited generics. And so then the physician has to get an approval from a clinical expert for prescribing more than the 4 brands. So what my understanding is, what they have seen is a pattern of educating physicians, and so then their branded prescribing rate has been dramatically reduced, and the savings have been quite substantial. I don't have numbers with me today on that, but I'd be happy to get them for you. My last conversation with the Medicaid director there was that their feeling was that was one of the most effective things that they have done.
And I know that certain individuals who remain nameless at this point in time 2 years ago thought that we were chasing shadows there. I never thought so. So if we could get some numbers on that.
We'll do that.
Mr. Chair, Washington has a similar program, and we are in the process of getting the numbers on that. And at this point, it seems to be effective, and it's being administered and done through the Medicaid program.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I didn't have a prepared presentation today, as Lisa's presentation is pretty comprehensive, but I would like to bring the committee up to date on some of the discussions that have been going on between us and OMAP and what's happening with the reimbursement rates. Those things have been moving pretty rapidly. Before I go further, I do want to say we're focusing a lot here in this discussion this morning on drug costs. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact of the benefits of prescription drug therapy. And I know a lot of what Lisa's talked about and what we've been talking about as an association gives a lot of heartburn to my friends who represent the manufacturers. But we shouldn't lose sight, for example, that the anti-ulcer drugs have eliminated the need for surgeries for the most part in the last 20 or so years, and that used to be a major surgery. We can control congestive heart failure and diabetes and things much, much better, and that's been a huge savings to the healthcare system. Our approach is that, we hope there can be some agreement from our friends in who supply our pharmacies, is that we need to get the therapeutically appropriate product to the patient to get the appropriate therapeutic outcome. None of this is about denying a good therapeutic outcome to the patient or putting any barriers in the way of that. That said, obviously we have huge concerns around the proposed cuts in reimbursement. Some of you are more aware of what's happening with that than others, but the Department of Human Services initially proposed to cut again our reimbursement rate at the retail level from average wholesale price minus 14% at the moment to minus 17%, and it was going to be effective Saturday. That requires a federal approval, and the feds have not yet approved that. And while the department could do this on as little as, I believe, about a week's notice, they, as a step of good faith, agreed to push back till April 1 while we continue to discuss the issue. And we've had two lengthy meetings with OMAP in the last week to talk about a number of cost-saving options, some of which Lisa's talked about, and they're trying to get those priced. And some of that information is coming back to the work group on the Oregon Health Plan. So we think that's been a really positive discussion, and we're making progress. But we implore you to, if necessary, step in and tell the DHS not to do this, because I can say with a high degree of confidence, although people cannot tell me directly what they're going to do without violating antitrust, I do know what the statistics are on average acquisition costs, and I know how that plays out in terms of reimbursements at different levels. And it's safe to say that even now, at the current rate, most of the branded prescriptions that our people dispense are dispensed at a slight loss. And some of that is balanced off by slight gains on generics. But if we were to go to minus 17%, that would put the reimbursement so far upside down that many providers would simply not have the wherewithal to stay in the program. And that includes the big box retailers. And I've had conversations with senior people at some of the chains that market in our area, and they are tremendously concerned about the impact that this could have.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Representative Tillman.
Tom, that was, why are you selling them at a loss?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tillman, to some degree, there is a sense of wanting to serve their communities, and they're willing to take small hits to do that. There is a balance where while you may have in the overall mix, while you may be seeing pretty consistent small losses on brands, on the other half of the dispensing that's generics right now, you have enough margin that makes up for some, and depending on the mix of patients a pharmacy may make up for all that loss. A good way of putting it, I think, at this point is that at the current reimbursement rate, pharmacies are at best breaking even.
I still don't understand why they are sold at a loss. Why don't you charge more?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, the rate at which we can sell our members get paid is determined by Medicaid. It's not a negotiating process.
And so that's determined by Medicaid for branded drugs as well as generic. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, that is correct. The AWP rate is a ceiling. There's also what's called a maximum allowable cost list that applies to a lot of the generic products, and that's a lower rate yet. But all those rates are determined by OMAP statewide for the different classes of pharmacies. There's a different rate, or has been over the last couple of years, a different rate for institutional pharmacies, but which have higher costs because they do bubble packing and unit dose packaging for their patients.
If I may follow up again, this is just so perplexing to me. So you must buy at a bulk rate. I mean, you represent huge groups.
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, that's a good question in terms of the purchasing. I think Lisa's analogy is very good in that the price is determined primarily by class of trade. Retail establishments have one set of acquisition prices. Institutional pharmacies have a somewhat lower acquisition cost, and that includes hospitals. their acquisition costs are lower, and essentially the retailer has the highest wholesale acquisition cost in the pharmacy industry. And that's something we can't control. But there is a misperception that because you're, you know, say a big pharmacy, you know, a big chain like, say, Rite Aid or Walgreens, that you're going to buy at a lower rate than, the medical pharmacy down the street from here. And that's not actually the case. It's a very level playing field for acquisition within each class of trade. The large chains, of course, buy on their own, but the independents are 95% of them are part of buying groups that together are roughly the same size as a chain. I know the governor has talked a lot about bulk purchasing of prescription drugs, and we have some concerns around that. If, depending on how it's done, it may be a positive thing, but if you were to group all the pharmacies in Washington, Idaho, and Oregon together, they would not be as many pharmacies as there are in any one of the three biggest national independent buying groups or any of the top five chains. So we have our doubts that that would accomplish a great deal.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to finish up a couple of quick points related to reimbursement and the discussions that we're having with OMAP. You know, the whole AWP minus 17 rate came out of an Office of Inspector General's report from the Department of Human Services, Federal Department of Human Services, last fall. The pharmacy industry had some tremendous concerns with the methodology of that report and obviously the results of that report. And the Inspector General has, in writing, communicated back to our national organizations that were working on this, that their methodology was in fact wrong and the results were in fact incorrect. And so, but unfortunately, the word hasn't seemed to get down to the state level that they need to be corrected. The other important point is, you know, that where the Inspector General has been trying to go over a series of reports over the last year or two is to what we call a dead net acquisition cost, but at the same in the reimbursement rates, because of the AWP system is hard to understand. At the same time, though, the Inspector General has noted in several of the reports that as states lower reimbursement rates, as the percentages off AWP, they also should be looking at their dispensing fees. And our dispensing fees have also gone down. And you know, right now, the dispensing fee is $3.50, whereas the pharmacy's cost of dispensing, on average, in the state of Oregon at a retail establishment, is just under $8 and rising quickly, along with other healthcare inflation, mainly because the cost of our personnel is going up. The last thing I wanted to touch on is...
John, this is just blowing my mind. So you're losing money on the drug, you're losing money on the dispensing fee. Mm-hmm. How can you stay in business?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, that's a very good question, and I wonder some days myself. The fact is that pharmacies are operating on extremely thin margins. I believe the averages now are in the net 1 to 2% range. And the delivery system in pharmacy is extremely fragile at this point. The combination of what's happened in Medicaid programs, what's happened in third-party reimbursement, has just been a very difficult environment now for pharmacies to operate in. Of course, next we're going to have a Medicare drug benefit at some point, and depending on how that's constructed, that could have a big impact. I just also wanted to note that in terms of working with the department, we're not just tasking them with all the to-dos on pricing the things that we're bringing to the table. Oregon State University School of Pharmacy very generously has offered to assist with some of this. Lee Strandberg, professor there, who is an expert in managed care pharmacy and in preferred drug list management, and was actually one of the architects of the Oregon Health Plan in terms of working with OMAP to establish the system, has volunteered his time to do some analysis of the Oregon data. And so, you know, we're doing as much as we can, working as fast as we can, and we've pulled some people in to, you know, join all of you in working some long hours to try and solve this very serious problem that we have. As the Chair Cruz, as you know from our work groups, the budget hole in Medicaid is enormous, and it seems to keep getting bigger every meeting we go to. So,
it's stabilized, I think.
Yeah, but you know, we do have a ballpark at this point that an enhancement building on the Health Resources Commission process of a preferred drug list with a strong preference toward generics. The first cut of the data appears there'll be roughly a 10% savings off expected spending in the general fund, which translates to about $50 million in annuals. And that's a ballpark, and we're working on getting more exact numbers. But I think it gives you some idea of the scale of what's available. If we can work together with OMAP and be able to keep our provider network intact to be able to work with them, I think we can make a lot of progress. And with that, I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relationship to Representative Tamayo's question, it would seem to me over the past few years we've seen all pharmacies, surrounding their pharmacy with gifts, with candies, with humorous greeting cards, with anything that has a high profit margin. Does that relate at all to the losses they're taking?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, that's a very astute observation. That's what we in the industry, you know, refer to as the front end, because traditionally the pharmacy counter is at the back of the store. The margins are so bad for the actual service that we're there to provide that many pharmacies have other retail business that they're trying to do, and it's a challenging environment.
Okay. One more question, and we're going to need to move on to another panel here. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a very dear friend who owns a pharmacy in the Portland area, and one thing that she had said would curb costs, which you haven't mentioned, and which I really don't agree with my friend, and that's about copays. And you haven't really mentioned about copays. And just really briefly, and I know that's a whole other subject. Have they worked? Do they
sure,
work?
Sure, I'll be happy to address that. Sure. Chair.
Make it very short. It's
Representative Anderson. We have mixed feelings about copays. The way that they have been done to this point in the OHP plus population, we have such strong objections to that we are in court about it at this moment, because those are voluntary. The patient ultimately does not have to pay them. We also don't think it's appropriate for there to be copays for people who are very, very low income and really don't have the money. That said, I think we have consistently said and have testified before this committee in previous sessions that we do support mandatory copays that have some kind of a means test attached. In the OHP standard program that we may not have a drug benefit for after tomorrow, there is a $15 mandatory copay. Clearly, there is some benefit to cost sharing when you have people who do have funds, because it can make them think twice about it. If we were to continue to pursue copays, our strong suggestion would be that, A, there be a means test, and, B, that we simply don't do them on generics so that we incentivize the patient to think twice about whether or not they really need that product that they just heard about, when, in fact, they might do just as well therapeutically on a generic product, which is the same thing that happens with the card that I take into my pharmacy. I pay 50% of the cost on a branded product or $10 on a generic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Dalto, I know that these early floor sessions probably cut into your courtesy schedule. So I was going to say that you know, if you need to do courtesies in committee on Friday, we could make allowances for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Inside joke. Judith and Ron.
Hello, my name is Ron Hartman. I'm manager of government affairs for Geneva Pharmaceuticals. Geneva Pharmaceuticals is one of the largest generic manufacturing companies in the United States. First of all, I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak today. It is well documented that the use of pharmaceuticals reduces excessive hospitalizations, emergency room visits, doctor visits, surgeries, and other medical procedures. It is the best method of lowering costs in the medical field and the Medicaid program. It is no secret that drug costs continue to rise as newer drugs enter the marketplace. However, it should be noted that many of these new drugs aren't necessarily the best drugs. In many cases, the same therapeutic outcome can be achieved with the older standby drugs that have been available for years and are usually available generically. It is a well-accepted fact that the quality of generic drugs certainly equals their branded counterparts. Since generics are of the same quality, then there is no reason they should not be used in every situation where feasible. In fact, I have a recent quote from the FDA addressing the quality of generic drug products. Quote, be assured that if the FDA declares a generic drug to be therapeutically equivalent to an innovator drug, the two products will provide the same intended clinical effect. This quote was from Dr. Jane Henney, then commissioner of the FDA. In order for true cost savings to occur in the drug segment of any treatment program, there must be an increase in generic drug utilization. According to a recent study by Brandeis University, it has been estimated that for the Medicare population, there would be a savings of $14 billion in a drug cost alone in 2003 if that segment of the population were subject to the same generic incentives as practiced by third-party payers. The big question is, how can generic drug utilization be increased? Some examples of how this can be done is by, number one, decreasing or eliminating the patient copay for generic drugs, by increasing pharmacist reimbursement if a generic drug is utilized, incentivize the pharmacist basically to utilize generics, and by utilizing step therapy protocols, where certain protocols are followed based on a diagnosis with less expensive generic drugs used initially, then this can be followed by more expensive drugs if treatment failure occurs. There are many other cost-saving methods that can be utilized, and I believe that Judy will touch upon some of these. I just want to emphasize the importance of drug treatment and the place that generic drugs have in the overall scheme to save money. I would also like to comment on legislation that would increase the rebate on generic drugs used by the Oregon Medicaid program. I believe this type of legislation would only serve to be counterproductive if cost savings is the ultimate goal. The average price of a brand name drug on the Oregon Medicaid program based on CMS information for the year 2000 was more than $60. This compares to the average price of a generic drug of less than $18. Another bit of dramatic information is that generic drugs accounted for 51% of the total number of prescriptions on the Oregon Medicaid program in 2000, but only accounted for 23% of the total cost. Conversely, brand name drugs accounted for 49% of the total number of prescriptions, but a whopping 77% of the cost. I bring up these figures only to emphasize that the generic drug business is really a commodity business. Multiple generic competitors for the same drug product have driven down the price as it does in any commodity market. In some instances, our drug cost is 80 to 90% of the price we, meaning the generic manufacturer, sell the product for. This means we have little gross profit to work with. You can imagine what a 15% rebate would do, even an 11% rebate does to our profitability. There is very little with some specific drug products. the generic manufacturer only has two options, raise our price or discontinue the product. Either way results in higher prices and would only serve to be counterproductive to the Oregon Medicaid program. We can certainly appreciate the fiscal problems that every state, including Oregon, are currently going through, but frankly, with higher rebates, we cannot afford to sell our drug products. For these reasons, once again, I urge you to oppose any legislation that would increase generic rebates. In conclusion, I would emphasize that the true path to saving money in any drug program is to increase the use of generic drugs and not to penalize the pharmacist or the generic drug manufacturer providing a low-cost alternative. That concludes my testimony. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Question?
Yes.
Do you have much research in your in the generic industry?
No, we don't. Our research and development is basically to develop, to mimic what the brand name drug is.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I know there's different sections, like Indian Health and military are different. What do you have any idea what kind of percentages of generics Indian Health or the military? Are they using brand names or are they using the generics?
Generally, I know we sell a lot of product to them, but I'm not sure what the percentage is, but I would imagine that it's probably a lot higher than in the general population.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Judith?
Great. Vice Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony today regarding some pharmacy cost-saving options for the Oregon Health Plan, including ways to reduce costs by increasing your state's program utilization of more cost-effective generic drugs. I'm Judy Milford, Vice President of Government Affairs for Teva Pharmaceuticals, and I'm here on behalf of Teva USA and as an advocate for generic pharmaceuticals. I'm a registered pharmacist with experience encompassing hospital, retail, and manufacturing. Teva USA is one of the largest generic companies in the world, producing pharmaceuticals in all major therapeutic categories. Today, nearly one out of every 16 new prescriptions are filled with a Teva USA product. Teva operates in all states and has good relationships with both regulators and customers. Teva's number one public policy goal is to make sure that all Americans have access to safe, effective, quality, affordable pharmaceuticals. We believe that increasing generic utilization is the solution to the rising cost of prescriptions. Based on recent data from CMS that we distributed to you today, based on CMS's the Medicaid program in Oregon, a 1% increase in generic utilization would result in approximately $1.5 million in savings in your program. The average price of the brand drug on the Oregon Medicaid program was more than $60, whereas the average price for the generic was less than $18. Generic drugs accounted for 51% of the total number of prescriptions on the Medicaid program in Oregon.
Judith, I'm going to stop you for a minute.
Sure.
Because that isn't what your handout says. The second bullet says the average price of a brand name drug after rebate was less than $18.
Was less than $18.
I thought you had said that the average price of a generic drug was $18.
Was less than $18. I have the exact number if you'd like.
So it's a typo on your
I think you've miswritten. So the second bullet should say the average price of a generic drug was less than $18. Do you have your bullet there?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
It's hard to find good secretarial help.
Thank you. And
sorry
so that,
about that.
Is that after rebate? Is that what you meant?
Both the quotes are after rebate.
So the average price of a generic drug after rebate was less than $18, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Please
Thank
continue.
You. Thank you for pointing that out.
Continue, Judith.
Sure. On the other hand, as the handout says, that the brands accounted for 49% of the total prescriptions, but were 77% of the cost. And therefore, by increasing the rate of generic drug utilization, the state of Oregon can save millions. As the pharmacy community has already mentioned, states benefit when they find effective ways to promote generic drug utilization. While we support many of the proposals that NECDS has presented, I would like to just highlight a few of the few successful programs that Oregon should consider. One option would be to institute a strong, mandatory generic substitution law that would require physicians to request prior authorization and provide medical justification when they wish to prescribe a brand multi-source drug instead of a generic, instead of a less expensive generic. In addition, zero copay on generics is yet another incentive to increase the use of generic drugs. Another way to reduce pharmacy costs would be to implement a stronger and much more comprehensive preferred drug list in the Oregon Health Plan. Now that Florida and Michigan's programs have withstood legal challenges, many states are moving quickly to implement prior authorization-based preferred drug list programs to encourage physicians to prescribe more cost-effective brand and generic drugs. Most states that have implemented preferred drug lists have selected preferred drugs in many more therapeutic categories. With only four therapeutic categories in place, rather than 30 or 40, Oregon's preferred drug list is not nearly as comprehensive as most other states' PDL programs. The Michigan PDL program, for example, has preferred drugs in 40 therapeutic categories. Unlike most other states with PDL programs, the Oregon PDL program is also a voluntary rather than a mandatory program in the sense that physicians don't have to request a prior authorization to prescribe the non-preferred drugs. PDL compliance rates, meaning the percentage of the drugs who are prescribed the most cost-effective drugs, will likely be very low compared to other states. Michigan, for example, reports that they are getting compliance rates of approximately 90%. For this reason, it is unlikely that Oregon is saving nearly what it could from a prior authorization-based PDL program. It is important to highlight that the imposition of larger rebates on generic drugs may have a perverse effect on generic may have a perverse effect on reducing competition as generic companies discontinue valuable cost-saving products that that cannot be produced or sold in that would make economic sense. Why? Because the market for generics is one of the most purely competitive markets in our economy. Generic drug companies compete largely on price every day, and as a result, operate with substantially lower profit margins than those of brand pharmaceutical companies. As stated previously, the generic pharmaceuticals used in the Oregon Health Plan cost less than one-third of the brand equivalent, providing substantial savings to Oregon. Recently, in Missouri, several state legislatures introduced a bill that would decrease the generic rebate from 15 to 11%. An outside actuary for the state of Missouri has estimated that if this bill were to be enacted, that the state of Missouri would save approximately $8.5 million in the first year alone. However, with higher rebates, this could cause generic companies to opt out or elect not to participate in these programs, thus limiting access to the very products that could save Oregon so much. Indeed, the cornerstone for any cost savings prescription plan is the greater utilization of generic pharmaceuticals when clinically appropriate. As stated previously, a 1% increase in generic utilization in the state of Oregon would save approximately $1.5 million based on Oregon CMS 2000 data. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Judith. Any questions? Yes, Lori.
Thank you. And I'm not quite sure how to word this, but most leading drug companies deliver far more money to their shareholders and profits than they spend on research. You say you do not do much research, therefore you're not getting a whole lot of contribution from NIH. And they say that there's 50 to 60% of a development of a drug comes from NIH taxpayer money. Your shareholders' prices, let's see. Tell me about your shareholders and the amount of profit, et cetera, that goes to shareholders.
I'm sorry, I really don't understand the question.
I just want to know your business is run just like any other drug business, correct? But you don't do research. I guess that's what I want to get at. And so your profit margin is based, you say, on the ability to produce a very low-cost drug.
Low-cost and high-volume.
Low-cost, high-volume, and that's where your profit is obtained.
That is correct.
Okay, and then the shareholders are compensated through that very system, high-volume, low-cost. Your profit comes from that.
That is correct.
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Judith, I have a question. The figures you gave, a 1% increase in generic utilization would result in approximately $1.5 million in savings. Is that per year or biennium?
That's per year. Well, in the year 2000, based on the 2000 data.
Thank you. If I can follow up on Representative Monis Anders' question, I think what you were asking that I, and I'm not sure I can put in any better words than you did, but what is, we know that pharmaceutical companies, their lawyer used the word profit margin is 18%. Is that true for generic drugs also? That they're...
I do not know the specifics on what our profit margin is. I know on specific drug products we, in fact, lose money on some drug products. And overall, though, I'm not sure what our, but just by definition, it's going
to
be.
Could you get that to us, please?
Yes, sure. We should.
Great.
We could.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, could we call up Jim Gardner and Paul Nielsen, please?
Unless you don't want it.
No, it's fine.
Okay. Okay.
Good morning. Whenever you want to start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm Oregon Counsel for Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which is the trade association that represents the majority of the research-based manufacturers that produce the brand name drugs that are distributed in the United States and throughout the world. Interestingly enough, a number of our companies also have generic subsidiaries, including one of the prior witnesses. So we kind of have a interesting perspective on all of these issues. I want to begin by saying that that I think what you're seeing here is some of the difficult budgetary issues that Representative Cruz, Tom Holt, and I, and others on the OHP work group are trying to deal with as best we can in a constantly deteriorating budget environment. And I think that while what we say may come across as confrontational or painful, in fact, to some constituencies, it is all part of an extremely valuable exercise of trying to get at the question of how do we optimize the health for Oregonians and how do we do it in as cost-effective a manner as possible. I think that all of us, myself, Mr. Holt, and others, certainly the other participants in the work group, are all seriously engaged in that endeavor in a very forthright way that is characterized by full and frank airing of all differing points of view, if I can put it that way. What we're going to talk about today are a couple of different things. The first is the patient assistance programs, which have gotten a fair amount of attention recently, particularly in view of the proposal to eliminate the OHP pharmacy benefit for the OHP2 population, the roughly 100,000 people that are essentially on the chopping blocks for next session. As I've said in a couple of encounters with the press, we view these as a kind of a rescue boat, a very small rescue boat in a very stormy budgetary sea. They're not a panacea. They are absolutely no substitute for a funded Medicaid benefit. But they may be true lifesavers for people who are being deprived of their transplant immunosuppressant drugs or their AIDS drugs or drugs like that. We're going to talk about those programs. I'm going to distribute just for your review a set of descriptions of what other states have done to essentially streamline and optimize access to these programs, because as I'm sure some of you know, particularly those in the healthcare field, getting through the application process can be somewhat of a challenge, but there are things that the state can do, things that other states have done, to make that process easier, essentially software solutions that allow people to kind of develop what amounts to a common application, or at least elements of a common application that can be plugged into these programs. Georgia, in particular, has made some progress there, and we're going to be meeting with Bruce Goldberg, the head of the Office of Health Policy today to discuss ways in which we can work more cooperatively with the state to make that happen. In addition to those programs, which my colleague Paul Nielsen, who is with Pharmacia and is the chair of our task force, will discuss, we're going to have some discussion of a separate set of programs called senior discount programs. These are programs which allow low-income seniors at various income levels to access very substantial discounts on the drugs they need. A separate set of programs, separate criteria. And then finally, with your indulgence, I would like to come back at the end and reserve a little bit of time for response to some of the things that that you heard presented from the generic industry and from NACDS. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Nielsen, and I'll pass out the descriptions of the other states' programs on patient access augmentation.
Oh, questions? Oh. Are there questions for Jim before we move on? All right. Paul, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Paul Nielsen, as Jim said. I am Regional State Government Affairs Manager for Pharmacia Corporation, and I also serve as the with the task force as chairman here in Oregon. As Jim said, also we're going to discuss patient assistance programs in both of the varieties that the main varieties that they come in, and I'm going to have asked staff to also pass out a directory that has been referred to a lot lately here in the Capitol. The first type of program that we're going to discuss, and then after me, with the chair's indulgence, we'll have Ann Tweet and Russ Spencer come up and talk about the discount programs. But the first one is embodied in this directory. And this directory is a pharma publication that lists the individual companies, complete with phone numbers, 800 numbers, and instructions on how to, for patients and providers alike, to access these programs. And I want to stress that these are not discount programs. These are programs whereby the patient receives the drugs free of charge from the companies.
Could you tell us how they do that? I've understood that it was a complicated process. Can you tell me
Absolutely.
About that process?
Well, I can't tell you all the companies. I can describe the general process for you. And part of the problem with these programs, frankly, is that they're all unique. They are necessarily different. One company criteria for entry into the program will be different from the next ones. And I'll try to use examples from my own company because I know it better than anyone else's, obviously. But I do not want that to imply that that's the criteria that everybody uses or the procedures that everyone uses. And we might as well cut to that if that's your question. The way that it works.
Did I interrupt your presentation? Were you going to get to that?
A little bit. I had a couple other preparatory remarks. If you.
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. It's important to note, very important to note, that these programs are not new. They were not designed in the face of a crisis in the state of Oregon. I started out as a sales rep with my company in 1976. So we didn't have a program then. We gave drugs away in the form of samples to physicians' office. It was quite informal. It was not regulated. It wasn't. It was a, you know, a pretty loose setup. For better or worse, it's changed. In 1993, the company, our company, Pharmacia, known then as Upjohn Company, formalized its program, and we came up with a patient assistance program. We actually have three different varieties within that. One's for cancer, one's for growth hormone, which can be very expensive, and the other program is the main one, and that's for the rest of the drugs. The industry estimates, or based on surveys, that it gives away about $1.5 billion in 2001, and I think it's 1.7 in 2002. But I know that the 1.5 billion figure is correct for 2001. My company that year gave away in the neighborhood of $45 to $50 million worth of drugs across the United States. And I want to also make it clear that what I'm talking about is not include samples, and it does not include the drugs that are in our discount programs, nor does is that true of the patient assistance programs for the other companies. The normal sort of general process is that once you identify, or once a patient can find out about the program, they'll either call. They can either call the 800 number listed in most for most of the companies themselves. In some cases, the companies, I believe, require that a physician make the call. In all cases, I think you will find there has to be a physician involved in the program, because we simply can't give away drugs because people call the 800 number. So there has to be a prescription. There has to be a physician involved in that process. A legal prescriber for those drugs has to be involved.
Paul, what categories are in the giveaway program?
Categories in what sense?
Drug categories. You mentioned that there are several categories.
Oh, well, for my company, it would be, you know, the drugs that are not cancer drugs and not growth hormone. So, for example, Celebrex would be in that program.
But not growth or cancer.
But not growth hormones and not cancer drugs.
Thank you.
And again, I hasten to add, that's just my company, and we're a small part of this industry. We're, you know, maybe the 10th largest company out there, and we're soon to be, we're soon to be extinct, basically. But the greater point that I'm trying to make is that these things are necessarily different between the companies. Now, let me describe the process that I think you're probably most curious about as far as how a patient would get into it. In our company, and I'm given to understand, having talked to my colleagues especially recently, is that this isn't totally dissimilar. If a patient calls the corporation at the 800 number listed in this book under Pharmacia, they will be asked questions about criteria like, do you have coverage, and what's your income level? And if they fit the equation, and if the product that they're asking about is in the program, then they are believed. The company believes the information that the patient gives them, and if they get the prescription and all that stuff comes from the physician, that day they can get that prescription. Now, I know there are other companies like that. I also know that there are other companies that have a waiting period involved there. During the 30-day period for our company, that information that's given verbally is then verified with documents. That will pre-qualify them for a 5-month extension of that prescription. So then they're good for a full 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, if they still are qualified and it's verified, then they're on it for another 6 months. And so that's how our company works. Again, just my company.
So if I can just clarify that. So it goes through physician, they must contact a physician. Does it go through community clinics if someone is in a clinic? Jim is nodding his head. So if someone is going through a clinic, that would also be covered?
The clinic?
Medical clinic?
I'm not sure if you're asking if the clinic would be covered or the...
Can I try to...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Safety Net clinics are one of the prime originators of these applications. Dr. Goldberg, for instance, who previously was medical director at Care Oregon, has told us that he's spent a lot of his hours of his life, you know, working on these applications. So I think Safety Net clinics are particularly aggressive users of the of these programs.
Okay, let me ask one more question. So for each drug, one has to go, if somebody is taking half a dozen drugs, for each drug they need to go through the same process, is that correct?
They would if they were made by different manufacturers. In the happy circumstance that they're made by the same manufacturer, then they would be, you know, able to go through on the one process.
They have to go through that
but frankly, that would be unusual. Because of the competition in our market and because of the many manufacturers involved, the odds are that they wouldn't have two drugs made by the same manufacturer.
Thank you, Paul.
Question?
Yes?
Just a follow-up. So a person, when they get a prescription, would they know what drug company to call? There's over 50 of them.
Yeah.
And so is it on that prescription as to what drug company they're...
Well, Representative Mona Anderson, that's kind of what we're here for, is to get the word out that they need to get, and the doctors need to get in touch with people if they know they can't afford the product. And in this state, as you know, tomorrow that will be, you know, a more serious discussion.
That's not my question. You say certain drug companies only produce certain drugs, and a person gets a prescription for, say, let's just take a blood pressure medicine like Zyac. They choose Zyac. They won't know which drug company to call. How would they be able to figure out which drug company?
Okay, I understand your question now. Thank you, Representative Mona Anderson. We recommend that, you know, people get in touch with the physician should be able to tell them what manufacturer is making their product. There are references such as the PDR, which will list, has a generic index at the beginning, and it cross-references several manufacturers if there are several manufacturers. And then the pharmacists and any other caregivers that are around are usually pretty adept at this. And in fact, I'd like to proceed a little bit with this, and you can get more of a flavor for that aspect of this, if you don't mind. I want to make one thing clear, too, before we leave the criteria. There is a lot of focus on the federal poverty line for a lot of programs, but I would point out that that's not the whole equation here, that there are situations with my company where if you have an income and it's, you know, a couple 100% of poverty or, you know, whatever, you can still qualify for the program if you have devastating medical expenses. By the same token, if you have no income but you have a, you know, a condominium in Switzerland and a chalet somewhere else, you might not qualify for the program. So there's not a cut and dry equation necessarily for that. It doesn't always just hinge on the federal poverty line. Now, I think that might be different for the discount programs that are coming up. But what I'm saying to people is, don't get your expectations so high that you think this will be the answer to your questions. But also, do not forego looking at these programs just because you think you don't assume that you don't qualify. Is the only reason I bring that up. I want to also get to, we've had several discussions around the Capitol with many, many groups. Mr. Hazelwood and I talked yesterday, and one of his great concerns is the difficulty of access and the fact that, you know, people who are on these drugs are many times just not equipped to handle the complexity and the problems of getting to all these different programs and understanding how to use them. And we're working on that. We think we're going to be able to make some progress on that in the future. there are other considerations here in Oregon. And doing some research for this presentation, I called a few of the institutions around and talked to some providers, and I discovered that, for example, major provider in Portland uses 2.5 full-time people that do nothing but access the patient access programs. And they also spend, I think it's important to note, some of their own resources on drugs that are not available through the patient access program. So we're not the only people who are involved in this activity. The providers in Oregon are also, for example, the Christmas Tree Festival that is held every year. Some of the money for that goes for a program that buys pharmaceuticals for people who present to the hospital. And why do they present to the hospital? Because they don't have pharmaceuticals. And so what they do is they check them out after their hospital stay with some pharmaceuticals. 5/6 of the products that they're checked out with, or that they are given drugs through that program, come from our patient access program. The other 1/6 are the products that they buy at this institution. Another one in the Willamette Valley uses 5 full-time people to access our patient access programs. So we understand that they're doing that because of the complexity of the system, but also because it makes good sense, for those patients. We also realize that these programs do create a burden and a problem for physicians and pharmacists alike, because they become involved in these things, and so they're part of the chain here that starts with the companies. We recognize that and we appreciate that. Perhaps the most important people involved here are the friends and relatives of the patients who are applying for these programs. I talked also with Jacqueline Zimmer on area aging and area agencies on aging, and she said that volunteers are involved in this process of helping people negotiate these systems. Also, Joe Koss with United Seniors, they're involved in part of this work, and all the advocacy coalitions that seems that we've talked to are at least aware of these things. Also want to point out that there was a flyer going around the Capitol yesterday by the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disability. And I talk with these people. We agree with what's in this. They're right. This is not a substitute for what the state probably needs to do in terms of taking care of people with, or somebody needs to take care of these people. It can't just be these patient access programs. So we totally agree with the sentiment that they have expressed in these things. And we invite the other advocacy groups to join us, and we will join them in trying to stitch together some sort of a mechanism for getting these things out to people. All right. I think I'm done with my presentation. There's no other great momentous things I think I need to say, except that, not that I've said anything momentous, but I would just say that we appreciate very much, Chairman Cruz and Vice Chair Tomei, the opportunity to be here. We don't think this is a solution, but it's important that people understand this. The last thing I'll leave you with is we did a survey of companies, of states, for member companies. We found that 35,000 patients were served in Oregon by the patient access programs in the year 2001, and 34,000 were served in the state of Idaho the same year. We think there's probably some headroom here where the state of Oregon could take advantage of these programs. Thank you.
Could I add just one word on that? And I do have a handout that documents the figure that Paul just gave. That figure of roughly 35,000 people in the state of Oregon, if that figure were adjusted by the population difference between Idaho and Oregon, Idaho has roughly 1/3 of our population, the number that we would be serving in Oregon, and certainly this is a worthy goal for you, for us, and for the advocacy groups, would be 100,000 people, which just coincidentally happens to equal the number of people on OHP standard who tomorrow will lose their drug coverage.
Thank you. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. I do applaud you and the efforts that you are doing here, and I would hope that because we're
dropping coverage for many of these folks, that some of these companies will decide to still stay around. I have a question regarding, I have a physician, family practice in Gresham, who said, I can't do this, Lori. I have 200 patients. There's no way that I can hire staff to go through this type of thing. Is there any way that pharma would want to provide the case management or have a centralized staff to process some of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonus Anderson, we're going to be talking to Bruce Goldberg about similar issues today. I think in some of the states that are described in the handout, pharma did make charitable contributions to a nonprofit that, along with other resources, community foundation resources, was able to provide that kind of service. There may be software solutions which help to get at that problem. For instance, one of the issues that you raised of IDing the drug, that's a fairly simple task. If you have a program that essentially you plug the name into it and it spits out, you know, here's the, it leads you right to the website for that particular application. I think that the industry's preference would be to work in cooperation with the nonprofit sector. We had a program that was actually funded to the tune of about $100,000 last session as a part of Senate Bill 9. The Senior Prescription Drug Discount Program, which would have set that kind of system up at OSU's School of Pharmacy. The money got yanked in the first special session, which was a fairly penny-wise and pound-foolish move in some people's view. But I think there are things that certainly we can do to work in cooperation with the government, with OMAP, and with the nonprofit sector to address the issue you raise.
And just to follow up, Monday night, I was in district. We had a forum about the basically all the cuts that was happening, and we did have a person. He was 50, a diabetic, disabled, and can't work. They had tried to access this program, but again, I think he really is eligible. It's just, and so thank goodness the YWCA was there. They said, "Hey, we're going to help you with this," but those are our nonprofits, and man, if we can get the word out that maybe they can get some money from you to help them with the staffing to help these people, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, I think that's right, I think we ought to view it more as a collective effort of which we're a part, but we've been approached by folks active with some of the major foundations in Oregon who said they'd like to also consider pitching in to that kind of effort. I think it is really will work best if it's a broad-based community effort that involves the nonprofit sector, the advocacy, perhaps some indigenous foundations, and just all of us trying to stitch together a safety net, if you will.
Are you providing any generic drugs? Patients who are low income?
Well, you know, Vice Chair told me, I just found out yesterday that one of the companies actually does have generic drugs. That what I mean by that is that they were the innovator, and then other companies came on, and now they're the other companies are producing this as a generic. Mm-hmm. But the company that invented the product is actually giving it away as a part of the patient assistance program.
One of the concerns. One of the concerns I think I've heard expressed is that you're providing the more expensive brand drugs than the generics. So, do you want to respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, it's an interesting issue because I think you heard a very accurate description of what the nature of the generic business is, which is a very it's a commodity business. That's just the nature of what it is. And those, to my knowledge, with the exception, the fairly rare exception of a innovator company that also has maybe a generic version of that particular product, to my knowledge, there are no patient assistance, and please, I hope that someone in the audience will correct me if I'm wrong, but no patient assistance programs for generic products. And very often, again, with rare exceptions, once a product goes generic, it moves into that part of the market. And so it's not something that we're making anymore, essentially, our companies aren't. So and one of the reasons also, just with your indulgence, Chair Cruz, one of the exact reasons why I say as often as I can that this is no substitute for a funded Medicaid benefit is precisely because a number of the drugs dispensed to the Medicaid population are generics. And as you correctly, have noted, those often, with rare exceptions, are not available on the patient assistance program. So it's one of the really good reasons we can't view this as a complete substitute for a funded Medicaid benefit.
Did you want to respond to that, Paul?
Actually, I wanted to make one little point that I hope the committee members are clear on with respect to an earlier presentation, and that is generics are mandatory in this state. If a physician writes a product that's available generically, then the pharmacist doesn't get reimbursed for anything else unless there's an exception made in that particular case. I don't know how often that happens, but I just want to be real clear that those other issues are not about using a high-priced brand name versus a low-priced generic if it's the same drug entity.
But my question was, does your company provide generics in their program?
I actually don't know.
Okay.
Frankly, I doubt it.
Okay.
I doubt that they do.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I know that we want to hear from Ann Tweet and Russ Spence. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You're wearing two shoes now.
What?
You're wearing two shoes now.
Yeah.
Another inside.
Progress.
You must be doing better.
Two shoes started on Tuesday, Mr. Chair.
Slow.
You've been busy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Tweet with Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, and together with my colleague, Russ Spencer, with Pfizer, we're going to talk today about another tract of patient assistance programs that have cropped up in large response, in part as a response to the fact that while there's been a lot of talk about a Medicare drug benefit, it's still in the works in Washington. So, as a response, several companies have developed programs that will actually aid the senior population, senior disabled population, those folks who are actually eligible and on Medicare, which of course does not cover the vast majority of prescription drugs, with access to those products that they need. The program that I'm going to talk about is called TogetherRx, and it's in this folder that that staff just passed out to you. And it's actually a combined effort of eight different companies. So eight companies with one card. That's Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca, Aventis, Bristol-Myers Squibb, GlaxoSmithKline, Janssen, Novartis, and OrthoMcNeil. And basically, through a self-certification process, that is the application that's at the last page of that book we gave you, folks will provide information to the TogetherRx administrator, and based on their self-certification of their income and Medicare coverage will be determined, their eligibility will be determined for this program. And what the program provides is a discount right at the point of sale. They'll obtain this card, and when they go in to fill their prescription and present this card at the same time, then they will get a discount on their pharmaceutical products that will be different depending on the company, because obviously all eight companies can't get together and decide what price they're going to charge for their products. But at the same time, we understand that the range of discount is anywhere between 20 and 40%. The program covers folks who are who have annual income of less than $28,000 for individuals and $38,000 for couples. And when Together Rx launched the program last June, they expect or they anticipated that about 11 million people nationwide will actually be eligible for the program. To date, we're looking at very close to 600,000 cardholders in the nation. Again, since June of 2002, and as of February 9th of this year, we calculate the savings that this card has produced for seniors at about $42 to $43 million. In Oregon, as of the beginning of February, we had just over 8,700 folks who had actually applied, received, and are using the Together Rx card. Based on the work that some of my colleagues and I have been doing in the past several weeks, I expect that the next time they report those numbers, they're going to be a bit higher, but the best data I have for you is from the beginning of February. The flyer that you have in front of you has yellow pages in the center that actually list the names of the products that are covered by this program, and again, products from eight different companies. And we're looking at about 150 medications that change, obviously, as new drugs come on the market, or may change as new drugs come on the market or go generic, depending on the individual company's decision as far as coverage goes. So the program is free, and as far as the application fee goes. And if you have any questions, I can be happy to answer them.
I have a question. How does a brand name drug become a generic drug?
How much time have you got?
Time.
20 days.
The passage of time.
I think I heard, yes.
Correct. But, and I'll ask Mr. Gardner to shake or nod his head as I'm speaking, but after I start speaking, that is, that from the time the compound is identified and actually filed with the Food and Drug Administration, the patent life starts running then. It doesn't necessarily mean that the drug is being marketed from that time or is even in a preparation that actually can be marketed or has been approved for marketing. So from the time of the identification of the compound to the end of the patent life, we're looking at 20 years.
Okay, just follow up. It would be nice if we could have brand names go to generic within 5 years, and maybe that would solve some of our problems.
And Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in many cases, patented drugs haven't even gone to market in 5 years from the time they get the patent.
Is that right?
So if it was for a great number of drugs, in fact, there would be absolutely no sales life or no selling life if, in fact, the patent were taken away only 5 years after it were registered.
Still, it's a good idea. Okay.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd point out that there's some federal complications in all of this, and the hoops that people have to go through just to get to market are cumbersome, and actually I think get in the way of patients having access to appropriate care, because it takes so long. Once a drug has been proven to be effective, it's still got to jump through a hell of a lot of hoops before we ever see it on the market. So you may be on the right track from the wrong direction there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair members. My name is Russ Spencer. I represent Pfizer Incorporated. And I've got a couple of things to bring to your attention this morning, both in the the Senior Drug Assistance Program, which Pfizer sponsors, is called the Pfizer for Living Share Card. That's this brochure that you have here. I feel a little guilty here because Ann has done her homework, and she has all her facts and figures on how many dollars saved and patients served, and I'm not prepared to tell you that, so I apologize. I'll be happy to generate that information for you. The Pfizer Share Card essentially functions, if you meet the eligibility requirements, $18,000 a year Medicare eligible and no other prescription drug program, or $24,000 a year jointly filed. Medicare eligible, no other prescription drug program, then you are issued a card, a share card you take to the pharmacy, and any product that Pfizer manufactures, you receive for $15 per 30-day supply, regardless of the cost of the drug, whether it's our most expensive or least expensive drug. In our case, we do have some generic drugs that we continue to manufacture. I was kind of laughing about this back there when you were talking about it. 15 years ago, when I started representing Pfizer as a contract lobbyist, our big breakthrough innovative drug was a drug called Feldene, which is an arthritis drug, which is now a widely available generic, and it was considered a breakthrough then, sort of a third generation or fourth generation now, and through the Oregon Practitioner Managed Prescription Drug Program, it actually made it onto the list. So 15 years later, I'm declaring victory. at any rate, $15 out of that $15, there is a dispensing fee which goes to the pharmacist and our good friends, the pharmacy out there, so that they don't lose money in the process on this program. On the back, you can see a list of some of the drugs that are covered. We make literally hundreds of medications, and it would be very lengthy to list all of them on here, but you can get a sense of the idea sort of drugs that we have. I want to point out two other programs to you that come under the category of patient assistance. We have a program called Connection to Care. This is the sheet that you'll see here. This is sort of a two-page, one-pager on our programs, but Connection to Care is a program done through the doctor's office, and you're familiar. It's very similar to the programs that all of my colleagues' companies run. We have the Share Card, which I talked about to you. We have a program through community health centers. If there is a pharmacy in a community health center, we will provide our products to that pharmacy for free, so that patients have access to any drug that we manufacture through that program. And then you see below that listed some medicine-specific programs, and this is also certainly not unique to Pfizer. Many, many drug manufacturers have similar programs. So you see Aggron, which is several products which we make for AIDS, anti-infectives. Aricept is an Alzheimer's drug. Geodon is a atypical antipsychotic, and then you see the reference down here to patients in need, because we co-market with Pharmacia Corporation, Celebrex, and Baxter, which are also arthritis drugs. So patients have access to those programs through Pharmacia, but we provide the link there as well. I think that I just would say that a couple of things I want to point out that you heard earlier. Mr. Gardner and Mr. Nielsen are quite right. We have a pretty good idea of the number of people that are eligible and would qualify for these programs. And we have a pretty good idea of, Ann has an exact idea, I didn't do my homework, but of how many people we've reached. And we know that there's a very, very significant gap out there. We know there's people out there that qualify for these programs that need these medications and aren't getting them. And we're doing our best to try to get the word out. Pfizer certainly has done both individual programs for the Share Card and is also doing these collective events with the industry, which I think are tremendously effective, because it provides what you're kind of looking for here, which is a one-stop shopping operation where people can come in and say, okay, here's my list of medications. Where do I go? And we look at the medications and say, okay, well, that's Bristol-Myers, that's J&J, that's Novartis, that's Pfizer, on down. It's been a tremendously helpful program in a microcosm sense, and something that we are very interested in trying to develop in a broad range as well. And we have many of these events, I think, are going to be continuing to go. We had them here yesterday in the Capitol. They've been ongoing and will continue out in the districts, and I would invite you to attend them. I think you'd find it to be quite an eye-opening event for these folks, and one which, as Jim or Paul pointed out, we've got these folks that are falling off the rolls out here. Not uncommon for us to have met folks that had 16, 20, 25 different medications that they were looking at losing funding for. And
Russ, I guess I want to ask about that. Maybe both of you, I should have asked other people. We keep hearing from people what a complicated process this is. And if they're taking 16, 18, 20 medications, and this comes from different pharmaceutical manufacturers, then they have to make that many applications. And for some of these people, especially people who are very ill or disabled, that is a very extremely difficult process to do. Mm-hmm. Isn't there some way that all of you can get together to develop one process so that people would go through?
Yes and no. In this industry, you're always dancing a very careful dance around antitrust issues. However, I think that Mr. Gardner, in the document that he's pointed out to you here, has brought to your attention, and I'll leave it to Jim to really address this, but a number of innovative ideas that other states have taken on to try to develop clearinghouse concepts. I can tell you that I believe the industry is looking at ways to try to effectively and collaboratively bring that sort of a process together. I know that, for example, if you call the Pfizer share card number mm-hmm. and you say, I'm looking for Wellbutrin, this is Bristol-Myers product, what our people will tell them is, I'm sorry, we don't manufacture that, but here's the number to contact Bristol. And we try to do what we can to steer people to the appropriate places. Is there room for improvement and development there? Sure. And I think we're pretty proactively looking at trying to find ways to help expedite that. I think Jim makes a very important point that we're all stakeholders in this, and it really does need to be a partnership between the private sector, the not-for-profits, and the government.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Monsanto.
I want to go back to brand and generic again.
Okay.
Is it possible for some drugs, and I think I've heard this, I just don't know, that you've taken some drugs and made them generic sooner than they need to be? Is that, do you know anything about that?
That's a relatively recent development that it may be really only... I'm not very interested.
One or two drugs.
Yeah, not anything that I can tell you that Pfizer's involved with. It's the thing you need to understand about brand versus generic is the day a drug goes generic, the brand manufacturer loses 80 to 90% of their market share
okay.
like that.
That's right.
And that's why you find that some manufacturers do not continue to manufacture drugs that have gone generic because it's a terrible program to do it, really, is what it is. So... It's a complex issue. I did want to mention that also that I know you have a lot of issues on your plate this session. If the committee is interested, I'm very sure that Pharma and our member companies could arrange a presentation to let you guys understand what the process of taking a drug from an idea or a compound to market is. Because it may really help you understand a little bit of why prices are what they are. So if the committee has interest in that, we'd be happy to set something up.
Yeah, we'll do that. Dr. Sandy will set that up.
Sure.
When you mentioned the cost of drugs, and certainly they are high, and that's a constant complaint, a complaint that we hear very frequently is that one of the reasons that the cost is so high is because the high cost of advertising. Yeah, and also the high cost of promotions to physicians and doctors. So how would you respond to that?
Go ahead, have fun. Anne is nudging me because that's like my favorite topic.
Oh, good. I asked the right question.
And I think Jim has some overall views. I'll just give you a very simple example from Pfizer. Pfizer's budget for advertising and promotion includes samples and all sorts of different things, is around, I'm going to talk in round numbers here, around $360 million a year. Our research and development budget is $5.5 billion a year. And I heard our chairman discussing this on one of the CNBC shows the other day. He said, that's a pretty big number. It's hard for me to get my arms around it. So I prefer to think of it as $100 million a week. So essentially, our advertising budget is about 3 to 3.5 weeks worth of our research and development budget.
How much of your research and development budget is also provided by the federal government?
Very, very little. The National Institutes of Health will sometimes identify compounds, but they don't do the bench science on this. And this is, again, an issue. It's a very common misperception. And that's an issue that I think you would really benefit mm-hmm. in learning in this presentation that I'm suggesting to you. The bench science and the clinical testing and everything else that goes into taking a compound to an FDA-approved for human use pharmaceutical is a very long and complex process, which is almost entirely borne by pharmaceutical research.
Thank you,
Madam. Yeah, Madam Chair, if we had the budget in committee, we'd go down to San Diego and go through scripts and see how. And I've done that, and it's mind-boggling what actually goes on in these places.
Definitely. Just follow up on your question. The number of grants that you get for your research. I mean, you get a lot of grants.
Is it possible to know what kind of...
It was.
What do you mean get?
Well, you apply for grants, correct? Do you apply for grants? I guess I should ask that. Apply for grants through, like, NIH, in which you would, you know, you have an idea that you're going to research a certain... drug or
so-called era of the remote.
Well, I think it's probably the other way around.
Yeah.
We give that.
Madam Chair,
we actually,
yes, sir.
Madam Chair, I prefer if we're going to have a presentation on how we go from ground zero to the sky, which I think would be super for this committee. I would prefer to. If it's okay with you, Representative, to save that till we do that, so we're doing a comprehensive thing, not just pieces of it.
And at that point, too, Mr. Chair, we can give very specific examples of obtaining licensed to develop compounds that may have been discovered by NIH, but taking them through the life cycle, and just give you a very concrete example of exactly what that costs and the costs that are incurred by the research developers to do that. Research manufacturers to do that.
Any last question, Representative Parker?
I just very briefly want to say thank you for explaining that, because that's been like the gospel, that you're spending more on the advertising than you're on research and development. And I look forward to having the additional training. It's kind of like everybody knows legislatures make, you know, something brandy.
Thank you. Thank you all very much for your presentations today.
We have somebody in the audience.
Jim, did you have more?
I'm going to really, if I may, Mr. Chair, really run through this quickly. And this is kind of the painful part, because there are some issues of disagreement, and I want to just sort of highlight those. I want to say, first off, that as in the work group, we're trying to approach this in a constructive but at the same time very brutally honest way, and get all the issues out on the table so we can really try to understand what's at stake. I'm going to pass out copies of the OIG report, which Tom referred to in his testimony, and I assume that if he wishes, in due course, he would pass out copies of the letter that he referred to that's subsequent to that. We have always been extremely sympathetic to OSPA's concern about an adequate dispensing fee, an adequate AWP, and the margins that they have mentioned. And one of the issues that's on the table in the OHP work group to address that is greater use of mail order pharmacies. The state has a contract right now with a mail order provider which gives it drugs for brand name drugs at AWP minus 21% and generic drugs at AWP minus 60%. Now, that does not translate into a dollar for dollar proportionate savings, because it also interacts with the MAC level, the maximum allowable cost, and the federal upper limit. But what we're doing right now, one of the exercises in the work group, is costing out what the potential savings would be. 75% of all the drugs dispensed on OMAP are maintenance drugs. And so the concept would be that refills after the initial, like many health plans do, after the initial dispensing would be 100% mail order. An issue that has, Michigan was mentioned a couple of times, and I have a couple of items I want to pass out to you with regard to Michigan. The first is a study by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has not, if I can just get one of those.
And don't give away all your stuff.
The Kaiser Family Foundation has not exactly been viewed as a pawn of the research pharmaceutical industry. It's done some pretty tough studies on us, but it looked very realistically at the Michigan reference price prior authorization program very recently, and what I've given you is a kind of an executive summary of that, some of the key conclusions on that. If you look down to the second bold-faced paragraph, the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the uninsured analysis on Michigan's Medicaid pharmaceutical program found that the Michigan program was unnecessarily burdensome for doctors and in some instances harmed patients by delaying authorization to prescribe a particular medication. And it goes on to elaborate on that theme on the second page, noting a particular harm that has occurred to HIV/AIDS patients from delay in prior authorization. It's the reason, that particular concern is the reason that the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan last session, Senate Bill 819, was deliberately crafted by legislative leadership to include a physician-driven exception process to avoid exactly this kind of harm that's documented in the Kaiser study of Michigan. And finally, I would be remiss, because I think we're all concerned about cost of drugs. I think all of you have expressed that concern. And what I'm going to pass out now is an investigative report that was published in the Michigan press, because, again, Michigan has been a subject of some concern, that looked at the price differentials at retail of generic drugs. And just to sum it all up, there's a paragraph in this report right before the first bullet. We went to store after store after store for a generic that cost the pharmacy only about $2 and was being sold to many of you for as much as $100. There is a report that the Arizona Attorney General has developed, which we will be sharing with the committee, that goes into this in some greater detail. The essence is there is tremendous disparity at retail of prices for generic drugs, and as a result of that, tremendous differences in markup. The antidote to that, I would suggest, is not state price controls or heavy hand of government, but simply more awareness by the public about how to be a smart shopper and how to go out and compare prices. We're hopeful that more information will get out to the public so that the public can be empowered to be a better shopper of those products. We're grateful that you have spent the time with us. We look forward to additional interchanges, and rest assured that we are committed to being part of the solution for this pressing, urgent problem the state of Oregon faces in terms of the general fund shortfall, and in particular, its impact on the OMAP drug budget.
Thank you. Jim, I have one last question. How much are the drug companies spending to advertise their patient assistance program?
I don't have an exact figure, but I think I can get that for you.
That would
and
be
we're
great.
About to expand that with some new
Good.
Web resources. I'll see if I can get that for you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Committee, just this is we heard from three key components of a delivery system for pharmaceuticals here today, which is three small pieces of the big thing called the healthcare delivery system. So all valuable, all with different opinions, so it gives you just a teeny flavor of what we're doing in our work group. So, and we will revisit these issues, and we're way late, so we are adjourned.
Thank you.